As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the 3-0 show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. It is Monday, October 23rd. Derek the Riper, Eno Saris here with you. Bridget Rowley out on assignment, watching the games in person. I'm still really jealous because this is a fantastic ALCS that Britt has been covering.
Yeah, it really is. It's been really exciting. The playoffs were not super exciting up until the CSs, I feel like. And I think maybe it was you that said that any moment it can change.
Well, I didn't say that, but that sounds like something I would say, so I'll take credit. Maybe I said it to myself and you heard it from thousands of miles away.
But it really can, because you can just have a walk-off win. You can have two series that go to 6 and 7, and you can have, you know, big swings back and forth, which are some of the things we were missing, I think, earlier on. I don't think none of the wild card races went to 3.
And, no, the first round was a dud. It's, for a round that's designed to sort of manufacture the urgency and the drama that you are getting right now from the LCSs, the wild cards were flat this year. I don't think that's going to happen most years. I think that's a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah. I don't know why it happened. I mean, there's, you know, and then we had the DS, where it was like the whole conversation was about, you know, rest and time off, and, you know, all these excellent offenses looking bad. I would just say that, you know, excellent offenses look bad in 3-game stretches all the time. And from my research, I had a piece come out where I tried to look at things like clutch and getting rusty. And in one of my examples was in the post All-Star game, like that game, that first game after the All-Star game. Results for hitters are better than expected after some time off. And for every hitter that says, yeah, you can get cold in that amount of time, even the hitters that did say that said, well, it can be good for your body.
Yeah, you could have things that hurt if you're not playing well going into the break. Just the mental break coming back could be a good thing. So, you know, I think because of who the teams were that struggled coming off of rest, I think that also increased the amount of conversation about it.
I mean, the Braves had one of the best offenses of all time, and the Dodgers are kind of a juggernaut, and to have those two go cold.
Yeah. I think that would, if you had different top seeds do that, I feel like the conversation's a little bit different, or at least less in volume. But we got a game 7. Coming up here on Monday night, and so much had to happen since we last recorded an episode in this feed. Keith and I talked on Friday, and at the time, between the two series, the biggest story was, what exactly are the Phillies going to do with Craig Kimbrel? That hasn't gone away. It's just been pushed down in importance relative to everything else that's been going on. Let's rewind to Friday. That was Game 5 of the ALCS. And the pivotal moment in the series at the time appeared to be Adolis Garcia hitting a 3-run homer off of Justin Verlander, taking the walk down the line, spiking the bat in celebration, which I have no problem with, and I'm sure as we've talked about this many times, you still probably have no problem with this. Just celebrating is part of the game. It's what it is. At that moment, it felt like, ooh, the Rangers may have turned this series. This could be the thing that propels them to a game five win. Two chances to close it out. Here we go. A couple innings later, in the eighth, still up 4-2, Garcia gets hit by a pitch with a runner on first base by Brian Abreu. Bench is clear. And as our friend Britt would say, it was a Springsteen. There were no punches thrown, which is a good thing. You don't actually want postseason baseball fights. It's a Springsteen, like a Springsteen concert. Everyone's just out on the grass, just having a good time. Yeah. I think it's a great name for what happens when there are no punches thrown.
Yeah.
Abreu gets ejected. Adelis Garcia gets ejected because as soon as he got hit, he turned and started kind of going at Martin Maldonado. Good job by the home plate umpire, sort of keeping that situation from getting worse. He stepped in, kind of broke it up like a hockey linesman, so a lot of credit there. Dusty Baker got tossed because, as it was explained to him, that they were ejecting Brian Abreu. He's like, well, why would we hit him on purpose? You could see the argument he was making. From a neutral position, you know, I didn't think that was a situation in which the Astros would retaliate against Adolis Garcia. So to me, I thought it was really a nothing burger. I thought it was actually a guy that missed a location in, and it happened to be in a spot against a guy that had tossed a bat celebrating a home run a couple innings earlier.
Yes. So it is really hard. And what I don't like about this whole thing is that we are attempting to do the impossible, which is get inside the pitcher's head. And the pitcher is not going to tell us he did it on purpose when there's so much on the line, a 2-game suspension. So we're sort of divining this. We're getting our divining rods out and looking for water, you know? So it's like, it's folly from start. What I noticed in the moment was Brian Abreu does not have great command. It's the main thing that's kept him from being a starter. He has a wide arsenal of great stuff, and one of the reasons he's not a starter is because of his command. So that's a thing to think about. And that's especially important because I was looking at the target that Martin put down, and it was for low. I'm fairly sure of this. I like watched it a couple times, and unless Martin Maldonado is just resting, it looks like he gives a low target. So I don't know. You can read that two ways. One way is, well, he just really missed his spot. You know, just that he just uncorked one. The other one was Abreu did it on his own.
Right. Yeah, he went rogue. And situationally speaking, maybe he thought he had cover. He thought, well, we're down a couple anyway, runner on base. Maybe I can strike a few guys out and get out of this. Maybe that happened. Nothing's impossible, but it just situationally didn't make sense because you don't usually see retaliation in the postseason in a still winnable game with runners on base. Like the timing of that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's usually like spring or like the next time they have a regular season matchup or something.
13 times they'll see each other in a typical regular season.
Yeah.
Like save it for April or May. Like I don't condone this, but that's what teams tend to do when they want to get back at someone. So all of that blows over. The Astros managed to get out of that situation, still down 4-2.
There are ramifications to this day.
And then Jose Altuve hits a 3-run homer steal this game for the Astros, which is remarkable. And that, even there was a glimmer of hope for the Rangers in the bottom of the ninth against Ryan Pressly.
Yeah, and they had two on.
The wildest thing of all, Travis Jankowski, who had to enter the game for Garcia, was the on-deck hitter. One more hitter gets on. You know, Travis Jankowski, more of a, you know, defensive replacement, extra lefty speed guy on the roster, would have had to come up in that spot and hit, which would have been peak drama to really put a bow on it. But there was plenty of drama in this game. And really, it was an instant classic, right? If you're a Rangers fan, it's one that got away. But overall, if you're a neutral observer, that was one of the best playoff games that you could draw up.
Yeah, Altuve has outperformed his regular season power in the postseason, but I think it's actually just a trick of the schedule. Altuve kind of had lesser power for the first 4 or 5 years of his career, where he kind of averaged maybe 8 homers a year for 5 years, and they weren't going to the postseason then. So their run of going to the postseason sort of coincides with him finding his power. So I think he performs well in the postseason. I'm not trying to take clutch away from him. I'm just trying to sort of explain that some of these things, when we look at them, you know, that's why it, it happens. Like if you look at Clayton Kershaw's poor performance in the playoffs, a lot of it happened when he was either A, fresh-faced right out the box, or B, washed and throwing 89. You know, and so there were a lot of actual good postseason starts in the middle there when he was, you know, a mid-career vet. But the Dodgers were going to the postseason every year, so you know, you kind of got the bad parts of Kershaw too. That's at least my personal theory on it. Maybe he's just not good in the postseason. I mean, he certainly has a large sample. Altuve is great in the postseason. It looks like 271, 340, 502 for his career. 471 plate appearances, 26 homers. That's pretty good. And I just love that he can hit a homer from anywhere from his nipples to his knees. I feel like he's one of these guys that covers so much of the zone and has such surprising pop for that guy. I feel like he's a Hall of Famer, and I know that there is a big sort of floating asterisk question mark about how voters are going to treat Astros and treat Altuve, but you know, especially if he adds another you know, couple of seasons on top of this, I really think he'll be a Hall of Famer up there with the best second baseman of all time.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being the final chapter of Jose Altuve's career in baseball. I mean, I think he's put the groundwork in for that to happen. I do think because we're seeing this team continue to have prolonged success, like their window didn't close 2 years ago. If that had happened, I think the way that writers and fans and historians mm-hmm. remember this team would be a lot different. But because it's been such an extended chance for new faces to emerge, for multiple seasons of success to occur without anything similar coming up, I feel like history is going to forget a lot of trash gate over time. Yeah. I think at least
guys on this team that weren't even part of that, you know,
like, right.
weren't even on that team. So,
yeah. So that just brings us to game five. There was also an exciting game six. The Rangers facing elimination back in Houston had Nathan Eovaldi going, and Eovaldi didn't have his absolute best stuff, you know, but he was good enough, and that's what the Rangers needed. It's been so important for Eovaldi to pitch well when his turns have come up because of the uncertainty around Max Scherzer, which we'll get to more in our Game 7 preview. Some of the questions about the depth in that bullpen, 6 1/3, 2 earned, 5 hits, 4 Ks, 3 walks, exactly good enough to turn it over to the A relievers for that Rangers bullpen.
Yeah, Eovaldi has this weird thing that he's been going into the last 2-3 years where he starts with a great velocity in the beginning of the season and it just tails off as the season goes on. He did that again this year, starting with 96-mile-an-hour plus velo in the beginning of the season, tailing off to 93-94 at the end of the season, bring it back up a little bit in the postseason, but still only around 95 in this last start. One thing that sticks out to me is that he cut his cutter usage in half, and he almost doubled his four-seam usage in the second time seeing these guys. And I just think it speaks to the value of having multiple pitches. If you think about somebody like Spencer Strider, you know, facing the Phillies over and over again, he's an excellent pitcher with great stuff, but how many ways can he change the scouting report back on the other team? And what you saw with Eovaldi is just, you thought I was going to, you know, cutter and splitter you to death. Today is the day of the surprise four-seamer in all these counts where you think these other things are going to happen. So, you know, that's I think the value of also you know, I've actually talked to players where they're like, oh, I'm saving that for the second half, or oh, you'll see that pitch more when I see them, you know, more down the stretch. So there are pitchers that kind of think about the full season and seeing teams more than once and like how many different wrinkles they can have. And the last thing that occurs to me when I watched Nathan Eovaldi start is I was talking to an advanced scout about the job of advanced scouting. And one of the things that's so difficult is, let's say you're facing, I don't know, Freddie Freeman, and you found some, you know, found some blue part of the heat map, right? You're like, oh, he's not good at the high fastballs, which is, he's still pretty good, but he's not as good, right? And so you put in the scouting report, not as good in high fastballs, so we should do that. Well, you know, I think some of the better teams or many of the teams are now sort of reverse scouting. So they're going to tell Freddie Freeman, hey, we were looking at your stuff, we're looking at their stuff, and you're very likely to get a bunch of high fastballs today, you know? And right. then the hitter right. can anticipate his own scouting report. And so then as an advanced scouter, you're like, well, do I just do the things he's good at? He'll never expect that.
It's next level, but I love it. It's like trying to find your own flaws before the other team does, or find them when they find them, and just say, hey, this is what you've been struggling with. So this particular guy you're going to see, he's good at elevating fastball. He can keep the fastball up in the zone. You're probably going to see that. And then all of a sudden, the unexpected happens. That's kind of great, actually.
Mookie Betts on MLB The Show has, like, it's all red. You know, they show, like, heat maps and stuff. It's all red. Except the middle is blue.
Because no one ever pitches him there. So he's just surprised when he gets a pitch there.
Got, like yeah, that. he's got a whole setup, you know, to hit everything else, or I don't know.
Where do your kids pitch Mookie Betts on MLB The Show?
I don't think they go middle, though.
Yes. I don't think anyone does. I don't think you can't bring yourself to do it. You can't trust it. You're like, no, nah, that's blue, but I'm not going there.
I don't believe it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's
the
little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Some more going on in Game 6, though. Jonah Heim, Mitch Garver both came through with some early homers. Garver, again, tacked on a pretty big RBI double in the 8th. And Adolis Garcia, coming off of 4 Ks earlier in the game, put a bow on it with a grand slam in the 9th to really put it out of reach. And there was some drama a little earlier. Evaldi actually hit Martin Maldonado, which you could have quickly interpreted as, oh, hey, let's keep this going. But in that case, that almost looked like Maldonado either didn't move his elbow out of the way or just like let it fall where the pitch was coming, is kind of like part of his normal pre-swing sort of routine. Nothing happened. So, you know, I think we've moved on from that. Josh Spores, kind of a big win for the pitching plus model that you've got, has been critically important to this Rangers bullpen. He got a huge double play. There was a runner on with one out at 3-2 in the 7th. He came in, got out of that trouble, and he's definitely in that circle of trust for Bruce Bochy, right? You think about the relievers that you want in the game for Texas when things are tight late in the game. Josh Spores is one of those relievers.
Yeah, it's interesting. By Stuff Plus, it just looks at the shape and the velocity of the pitches. He's ahead of Jose Leclerc. That's just really important to have another guy in the back there. Aroldis Chapman has the best Stuff Plus on the Rangers, and yet his Achilles heel has become very obvious as he's aged, and he has the worst Location Plus numbers on the roster, which is looking at just how good he puts it to places on the, it's like count and pitch type adjusted. Looking at like how well he places the ball, and he has no command. It's like it's amazing to watch someone who still has that top end elite stuff struggle so much, just because everybody is going to the plate not swinging, sort of waiting for him to get a strike before they start swinging. So
yeah, you could see how bad the misses are pretty easily with Aroldis Chapman. I'm curious, you mentioned Brian Abreu not having great command, having excellent stuff. If I had to guess, I haven't looked at the numbers recently, Abreu's command is probably even better than Chapman's. Chapman's command is like pretty much bottom shelf for guys that get used in high leverage spots, right? I mean, I can't imagine there's anyone Alexis Diaz, maybe in Cincinnati, would be my a
location
guy that has
plus Brian Abreu has actually really improved his locations. But I think that's probably because as a reliever, you can slim down what you need to do. You can just do your strengths. You don't have to think about turning lineups over and throwing this changeup you can't command that well or whatever it is. So I think he's actually sort of taking himself out. I mean, like a Chapman is it'll keep him out of being a closer. It's that bad, you know, even though the stuff is so good. So, and there was a big decision at some point. Chapman against Yordan Alvarez. Was that game six?
Yeah, I think it was game six.
It just happened.
Games at bedtime as a young parent blur together as bad
I'm
as
like
any
making
games
ribs,
can blur together.
Doing a fantasy basketball draft, watching the game at the same time. It was
the elite multitasking
Sunday night.
Yeah, it's dinner time on the West Coast. It's like bedtime if you're East or Central, and it's like.
But they left S'mores in to face Yordan Alvarez instead of taking Chapman in, and I took notice of that. S'mores struck out Yordan Alvarez, and there's some ability to get Alvarez, I guess, with low curve balls if you set him up. That's been a big thing, you know. That's how Jordan Montgomery got him out. Yeah, well, he's also lefty on lefty with a great breaking ball. So and you were on Alvarez, you know, even though he struck out then and Jordan Montgomery got him a couple times, he's the best hitter in this postseason.
It's not even close. He's absurd.
436, 477, 949 is his slash line right now. So yeah, he's intensely good, and you know, it inspired conversations about where he would rank all time, Yordan Alvarez, as a hitter. And you know, Rangers fans or Astros fans are like, you know, oh, you know, he's the scariest hitter of all time, like say Bonds or whatever. And, you know, you get some blowback from other fans being like, oh, what about Ruth? And da, 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 da. Yeah, he hasn't established himself. He hasn't had a full career like that. But to me, he's the scariest hitter of our generation right now. Him and Judge are 1-2 on that. And I don't think taking someone that's, you know, it's not that hyperbolic to like take someone who's the best hitter of your time and start putting him among the best hitters of all time. Yes, there's some like sort of projection and what's the rest of his career going to look like. But yeah, he's one of the best hitters of our time, at least.
Yeah. And I think what also makes some of these conversations challenging is the variable, how much playing time, how many times the guys get chances to shine on this stage. There are some guys who were really good in a handful of series, but their teams didn't get back. And in smaller playoff field eras of baseball, which is most of baseball history, there were fewer seats at the table. So that also adds a layer of difficulty. Now, what's interesting, if you look at all-time numbers in the postseason, I'm at the FanGraphs leaderboard. I just knocked it down to 100 plate appearances, just so we see guys who have been there a little bit more than others. Based on WRC+, Yordan Alvarez tied for 22nd all-time. Very, very good. Postseason. 151 WRC+, postseason only. Right next to Reggie Jackson, Mr. October himself. Which, nice. Yeah, there you go. That's a good spot. You look at guys that are in that range. Kyle Schwarber actually here too. Does it a different way. But 20 postseason home runs now for Kyle Schwarber? It's absurd. And again, number
of
games,
chances, right? But
you get more chances in this era.
251 plate appearances, you know, like.
right. Yeah, just relative to some of the other guys that have played a lot in the postseason, that's still really impressive. Mickey Mantle is in this range in terms of his all-time postseason numbers compared to Yordan Alvarez. A couple other modern
Big
guys, Giancarlo
right
Stanton. Stanton's actually got great postseason numbers. And the conversations around Stanton are not positive at the moment. What's interesting, though, you know, Bryce Harper is even better than Yordan Alvarez in the postseason so far. Over 200 plate appearances. Bryce Harper is seventh in WRC+ all time. The top of the list is Randy Arozarena is number one. Lenny Dykstra is two. Then it's Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Paul Molitor, George Brett, Bryce Harper.
Yeah,
fun list.
It's amazing. And, you know, one of the things that was difficult when I went and looked into Clutch is, you know, Bryce Harper this year, there's a stat called Clutch that looks at how well you do in late and close situations. And Harper was number one this season in Clutch. And then you look at this and Harper's, you know, in the top 10 all time. And in fact, if you make it 150 plate appearances, he's like third, you know. You know, it all lines up to be like, well, our subjective experience is that Bryce Harper is clutch, and the numbers seem to suggest he's clutch, except that 2 years ago, he was 50th in clutch. And then 3 years ago, he was 180th in clutch out of 188. He was one of the least clutch players in baseball 3 years ago. And so that's led sort of statistical analysis to say that clutch, if it is a skill, is a tiny skill. It's, you know, 2% of your overall value could be your clutch value. It's a couple points in batting average. It's something you only know after 7,000 clutch plate appearances. You know, it's like, it's basically the analysts say it doesn't exist, but I'm not comfortable saying that it doesn't exist either. What I say is we haven't proven that it exists, and that if we did maybe heart monitor type studies, we'd find that it exists. You know, there are ways to refine the way we study it. And then the last thing that I would say is, if you're truly, truly unclutch, your knees are knocking, you can't handle it, you're sweating, you can't do it, I'm not sure you become a big leaguer. So I think when we're looking at big leaguers, we're already looking at only the 200 best baseball players in the world. And if we're doing that, then there's no bell curve there. It's probably just a difference between very clutch and mostly clutch. You know what I mean? Like, we're not looking at people that cannot handle the moment at all, or else they probably wouldn't be in the big leagues, is my point. Like, they get washed out in college or high school or wherever. So that's sort of my theory on clutch. But it's a big disagreement between sort of players and old school and the analytics, is whether or not clutch exists.
Yeah, that debate, I think, will rage on forever. But it's similar to, you know, Keith and I were talking about lefty on lefty splits and the difficulty of even relying on those in a full season, because statistically it's the same problem. It's such a small slice that you can't really value it in any sort of way.
Yeah, reverse splits are not something you should really believe in.
Reverse splits, all of these different things, and clutch would fall into a similar bucket just because of those statistical
batter
limitations.
Versus pitcher numbers, you know, it's like
BVP, you know. You want to trust it. If you're the kind of person that plays daily fantasy or makes a prop bet or just wants to root for something to be like in your favor as a fan, you want to believe all those things, and they're true until they're not. It's just the way it works. I can't help you there. But at the same time, you're like, well, there's got to be something about the way certain pitchers work that favors certain hitters, right? You're a good fastball hitter, and this guy's best pitch is a fastball, and his secondaries aren't good, so you're going to see him well and hit him well. But it's not fully supported by numbers because the samples are simply too small. Last thing on this lead up to Game 7, I was really surprised. So Jose Leclerc bounced back, got out of some trouble in Game 6 after giving up the Altuve homer in Game 5. Kind of nice to get a good outing in, or at least an acceptable outing in after a blow-up like that. The Astros had a choice to make. They had the bases loaded. John Singleton came on as a pinch hitter instead of Yainer Diaz. I thought that was a weird choice. Like, I know you want the platoon advantage, you want to go lefty-righty when you can, but the identity of the hitters needs to matter. One of those guys was on your team for the whole season and was a well-above-average player, and the other was just trying to claw his way back into the big leagues. John Singleton's a nice story, but I don't think John Singleton's the guy you want to use in that spot.
It's also the backstory of Astros fans being like, why aren't we playing Yainer Diaz more? And like, you know, backriding
yeah,
Dusty
situation.
Baker.
Perfect situation to use him.
Yeah.
And they didn't use him. And I just, well, if you're not going to use him there, like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I guess, you know, yeah. And I think that what you were saying just a second ago about, like, there's things about the way, like, you could maybe there was swing plane stuff where it's like, you know, oh, he's a really good low ball hitter because of his swing plane, and this is a low ball pitcher. When you were, you know, listing out those best postseason players of all time, maybe they're clutch, maybe they're really good at high velo fastballs because the postseason is full of high, you know, the velo goes up another tick, you know, so maybe, and you start seeing the best fastballs that people have. So, you know, Bryce Harper, fastball hitter? Yeah, probably. So, you know, so that's something I was thinking about. But yeah, in that moment, I was just, I don't know that I processed like, oh, this should be Yainer Diaz. But I remember being like, wow, this is the guy up at the plate with everything on the line. That's not probably how the Astros wanted it written.
Right. You would expect a slightly better option for a team that good in that spot. And my argument is they had one and they didn't use him in that spot because they wanted the advantage. Maybe there was more to that decision. I'd love to know all the factors that were taken into consideration to lead to that spot, because they're probably very interesting. Now, looking forward, game 7, it's Max Scherzer against Christian Javier. We've seen this once already in the series. Scherzer said there were positives in his first start back after the long layoff. The results weren't as positive as he was about the outing. We talked about it last week. One of our theories on the show was maybe he's just psyching himself up because he knows he's going to probably have to take the ball again for this series to go the Rangers' way. How do you think they're going to manage him in Game 7? You know, based on what you saw, velo, movement, the arsenal that he had, the stuff that worked, the stuff that didn't, what do you think they're going to try and do with Scherzer in this decisive game to at least cut down on the list of fringy bullpen options they have to use to get through the full 9 innings?
I know, because I don't even think they want to go to John Gray or Andrew Haney, you know, who would give them some depth maybe if they needed to take Scherzer out early. But, you know, I think the one positive and the one thing I would look at early is velo. You know, he came back from a month off and had the same fastball velo that he'd shown. And it was one of the better, you know, on the better end for his fastball this year, which is 94 plus. So if he comes out throwing 94 plus, that's the first positive I have. And that gives him a little bit more leash. If it's more 92, 93, then I'm on the edge of my seat from the minute, you know, the game starts and about to take him out. The thing that was the negatives, I think, that we all agreed on was that he just wasn't commanding his slider and his curveball as well. And that's the thing I'd be watching otherwise, because that's going to lead to walks and that's going to lead to maybe homers. And that's going to be like a homer is that's what you're trying to avoid. Like a walk is okay, but if he got to that walk because he couldn't command his breaking balls at all, that might be, you know, that might be a quicker hook for me, because I don't want a 2-run, 3-run homer to, you know, put my team in the hole that I can't get out of.
It's so interesting that we're at a phase of Scherzer's career where I think if you had the choice between Scherzer and Javier, based on where they're at right now in their respective careers, who would you rather have taking the ball to start this game?
Yeah, I guess Javier. Javier got his fastball back. You know, he's been striking guys out again. The one weakness with Javier, though, is he's pretty much a two-pitch pitcher. I mean, there's only like maybe two pitchers that threw their primary two pitches more than him. He's like kind of a 90% guy when it comes to fastball slider. So, you know, he's going to have to be unpredictable somehow, and his command can kind of come and go. So, you know, there's some risk with him too. You know, hitting Christian Javier for me is sitting one or the other fastball or slider and just getting what I wanted at the right moment.
Yeah, and I wonder if the Rangers are, as a lineup, more likely to jump on one of those offerings over the other. I think that's something to watch really closely. The thing that continues to amaze me with Javier, you know, the strikeout rate's great in the postseason, his career, 12.5 Ks per nine. He does have an issue with walks, over 4.5 walks per nine in the postseason in his career. And you can even get him with the long ball, over a homer per nine as well, 1.2 homers per nine.
There was like a postseason series where they were, you know, not even going to use him, I remember.
And that might have been like a fatigue and something else may have been in play there. But still, what's been just unbelievable is the extremely low hit rate. 18 hits in 43 and a third inning so far for Christian Javier. And no matter how good you are, there's some luck cooked into that too. I don't know what his baseline really should be. Look at the regular season results and get a better sense there. But this is an absurd stretch to begin his career, just in terms of how difficult it is to hit him. For his career, 6.5 hits per nine, just to put that into the rate stat form. For his postseason career, it's 3.7.
Wow.
That's just bizarre.
Is that just like, I mean, for me, balls and player team outs. That's a refrain that I go to a lot. So, you know, it's not just Javier. It's good defense behind him. And maybe like really good prep work. Like, I do think that the Astros prepare for games, you know, at an elite level. So maybe this sort of conversation we're having about advanced scouting and thinking things through like that, maybe they are really good at that and really leverage that in the postseason. I don't know.
The other wrinkle here with Christian Javier is there was one regular season meeting. They obviously met earlier in this series. That was a wild game. The Rangers ended up losing 12-11, but they put up 8 runs on 9 hits over 4 1/3 against Christian Javier. So...
Was that was when he didn't have his fastball or something. He lost his fastball for a while.
July 3rd. It was more mid-season. Yeah, and that was when he wasn't pitching as well. Yeah. So that's part of it, right? It's like, well, where's that fastball at? Is he locating it where he wants? Is the velo where it needs to be? Prediction for Game 7? Would you like to make one?
Well, I've had the Phillies and the Rangers for a while in the postseason, so I'll just stick with that. And Phillies over Rangers. So that's, you know, what's funny is last year we did all these picks on the site and I had to do like daily picks and I kind of hewed close to like odds and what the, you know, what the projection systems were saying. And I did really poorly. And this year I sort of stayed out of the fray. I don't have to make daily picks. I'm not trying to chase my tail, on every game. And early, I think before this thing started, I said Phillies, and that's looked good. I think the Rangers are going to join them there, but it's going to be a good one. One thing I did want to say about Max Scherzer is, you know, I've seen some like his legacy is on the line and he's washed and stuff like that. Well, I mean, he is 39 years old and this is the end of a Hall of Fame career. You know, if you count the postseason, he's just about to hit 3,000 innings. I don't think that his postseason legacy is on the line here. He has in the postseason a 3.80 ERA with 11 strikeouts per nine, and he's, you know, 7-8 if you care about wins. It's not like he's has an extra level in the postseason, but he's had plenty of good postseason runs with people. He has titles. He has all the accolades. He's 100% a Hall of Famer. And, you know, what he does at 39 in this game, I don't think really matters for his legacy.
I'm 100% with you. And we go through this with players even beyond the postseason. We usually get it with the aging sluggers that get the long-term deal, and by the end of the deal, they're not the same guy they were at their peak. We did it with Albert Pujols. We just did it again with Miguel Cabrera. It might limit where you finish on an all-time list. Like, if you're not the same player you were for the last 5 years of your career that you were for the first 10-plus, it doesn't mean you weren't amazing for the first decade-plus of your career. Like, I think we're too quick to, like, start erasing stuff from past successes, like the end not being as good. Yeah, aging is real. It comes for everybody eventually. Very, very few players can retire with something left in the tank that's still at a crazy high level. And that's what would have happened if Scherzer had walked away like 2 or 3 years ago. But that's not fun. That's not good for the game. I think we want to, from a neutral perspective, you want Scherzer to pitch well, regardless of how you want the game to turn out. You just want to see a guy show up, give him 5 quality innings, keep him in the game, and, you know, let good plays somewhere else decide it rather than a night where he doesn't have his best stuff. That would be kind of the neutral sort of thing that most people would want.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be depressing to, you know, see him give up a couple homers in the first and be out.
Even with Kershaw, it's like, I don't want to see Kershaw go out getting smashed. Like,
that was awful. And it's hard. Like, there's a chance that's the last time we see Kershaw.
Yeah, that's like, I mean, for an all-time great on the field, you have players that just they don't get to go off to the confetti.
Yeah, Pujols was kind of lucky with that, man. I mean, I did not see that coming, that he would have this like sort of curtain call moment where he was good again and actually useful for his team. And you know, got everyone to smile one last time for him, you know.
Yeah, I mean, clearly respected in that clubhouse with the Dodgers during his brief time there. It was a big part of why they picked him up too, but he offered a lot more than I would have expected with the bat during that swan song with them. And of course, there was a little more time after that with that return to St. Louis, but I thought he was cooked when the Dodgers picked him up. I thought it was over just because it looked over for so long for him in Anaheim. We're still awaiting word on Brian Abreu's suspension appeal, by the way. That's going to be heard today.
That's the ramifications I was talking about earlier. Still talking about that hit by pitch. So he's appealed it, and once you get the answer, like, he's going to be suspended.
Almost certainly, at least for one game. It was a 2-game suspension initially. If they reduce it to 1, he misses game 7. And that's that. And
so
if
he's
they uphold it, it's seven plus 1.
And there's some, you know, Ken Rosenthal had a piece today about there's some grumblings out of the Astros that, like, you know, the league is showing favoritism to Chris Young because he worked for the league for a while.
Really? I don't know. Are they?
It's in Ken's piece.
The past precedent, though, here points to the most likely outcome being suspension upheld. Abreu doesn't pitch in game 7 and is, you know, out for another game if the Astros advance, right? Like, that seems like where it's going. Can't say it with certainty, but it's weird that we're stuck in limbo leading into game time. If you're the Astros, mm-hmm. you are furious about the timing of all of this because you'd like to know, is he available? Is he not available?
So we can
make the final plan for how you want to get through and manage everything in this game 7.
Also, just from incentives and what you want out of the game, you need to have these suspensions because you need to disincentivize hitting players, mm-hmm. especially anywhere near the head, you know? So you just need to have that in place. And if the particulars are uncomfortable and terrible for the Astros in this particular situation, you know, as a league, what are you going to do about it? You need to have these disincentives in place so that people aren't hitting people, even if, you know, you don't know that in this case it was intentional or if it's terrible timing or whatever. You still need to have these structures in place as a league.
Yeah, it's important because the number of unnecessary injuries that can occur when this is part of your culture, it's we've seen it. It's excessive, right? We haven't seen in a very long time the worst of the worst case scenarios, but that's always the concern. You miss trying to throw at somebody, you hit them in the head, anything can happen, right? So you do want to disincentivize that. I'm with you. I think they have to figure out a way in the postseason especially to get through the appeal process faster, but you need to build a case. But how long does it take to build a case? Like, these are pretty straightforward, simple procedural
things. And I can't imagine, what is the case? He says, I didn't do it on purpose, and they say, you did, and then...
Right. The umpires on the field all agreed at the time that they thought there was intent. But again, you're all trying to get in his head in the moment in a very emotional situation with 50,000 people screaming. I'm not sure that the judgment of someone's intent in that moment is going to be flawless. But
yeah,
we shall see. When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon Apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
I feel like we are like burying the NLCS, and we're really not. There's just been a little less drama by comparison. So two chances for the Phillies to close this one out at home against the Diamondbacks. Going back two games in this series, since that's the last time we were able to talk about it. Game four, Arizona winning a bullpen game was huge for them because they went down, of course, 0-2 in this series. Their two best starters, Gallen and Kelly, both coming up short at the beginning of the series was a problem. My question for you about game four was that this was actually a really entertaining game for a bullpen game, right? Like, it was full of drama. Alec Thomas hit the improbable game-tying home run off the bench. That was a really great moment. Gabriel Moreno got to Jose Alvarado with some inherited runners on to push the Diamondbacks into the lead. Craig Kimbrel remains a problem. That was all part of game four. But is a mid-series game in which 16 pitchers appear for the two teams combined, that's a nine-inning game, too. It's not like they played extras. Is that a problem, or is it just okay to have a game like this sort of sprinkled into postseason series? Because it seems like this is increasingly the direction we're heading in baseball, where most teams don't have four starters that they really like, that they want to throw out there for five-plus. So come mid-series, you sort of empty out everybody and just roll the dice and see if you can play the matchups right.
I actually saw somebody in a group chat saying they loved bullpen games. I was just a little surprised by that one.
Well, it's different when you're at home versus when you're covering it in the press box. I've never had to cover one in the press box, so they don't bother me to my core the way they might bother someone who has to actually be in the press box.
Theoretically, you could be seeing a lot of nasty stuff because bullpens are better than they've ever been. But in the case of the Diamondbacks, it wasn't all pretty. Sal Frank got out there and got one out, but three walks, a hit, two runs. Like, that wasn't very pretty. And it was kind of a little difficult to watch because he just kept missing the zone, you know? It's just like, come on, get it in there. It wasn't all pretty all the way through. Craig Kimbrel also in this one had such a bad game that his manager has since said that he's moved off of the ninth. In their case, they have such good other pitchers in Jeff Hoffman, Matt Strom, Sir Anthony Dominguez, Gregory Soto, and Jose Alvarado that they can use Kimbrel earlier in the game and still have a great bullpen, I think. But it did, in this case, lead to that Alec Thomas moment. We had a great time in the Sarah's household. My kids were finishing up bedtime. I had the game on my phone. I called them over. I said, here's a big moment. And they've been sort of rooting for the D-backs because they feel that the D-backs are the ultimate underdogs in this postseason. And I said, come on, Alec, you know, hit this homer, be a legend, you know, and then he hit the homer and the kids screamed and, you know, jumped into the plushie pile. And it was a great moment. So, a great moment for the franchise too. To pull them even in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, if you would have said Mantiply Frias, Kyle Nelson, Miguel Castro, and Sal Frank are going to get them through five innings against that Phillies lineup, I would have said, you sure about that? Like, how many Phillies were unavailable due to an illness or something? Like, what caused the Phillies lineup to be down that particular day? But they got through it. Now, the Phillies hit Zach Gallen again in game five. It was a massive swing game because now the series is back in Philly. Phillies get the two chances to close it out. I think the thing that was really the takeaway for me in game five, and it's been there for a couple of seasons now, Zach Wheeler, you know, the free agent contract he signed with the Phillies before the 2020 season, it was 5 years, $118 million. So he's only got 1 year left before he hits free agency again. He's old enough where he's not going to cash in at a crazy high level, but the AAV is probably going to be pretty nice if he's healthy and wants to stick around for three or four more years. That's going to go down as a huge success story in modern free agency. And part of it, I think, is that when you saw Wheeler, when he was healthy with the Mets, he showed, you know, four war plus sort of stuff in terms of results. He was showing he could be a frontline sort of guy. So my question for you is just, you know, beyond health, what has enabled Wheeler to be so good? Because I think there were some people out there that didn't like that contract at the time the Phillies signed it, and now it's going to go down as a big free agent value.
Yeah, I mean, there's like this velo piece, this return from TJ piece. He really, I think, has pushed velo in a way that people are a little bit surprised in terms of his age and where he was, frankly, velo wise as a prospect. He was nowhere near this. He did not have great velo as a prospect. And so he's added that velo. He's come back from TJ. And what I think makes him excellent is that each of his pitches is really good and he has great command. So he has velo, stuff, command, and a wide arsenal. And if you look at Fangraph's wins above replacement, he's the number one pitcher in baseball over the last three seasons. And I think that's surprising to people. Some people would say, well, that, you know, that stat is flawed, and they might be right, but, you know, and then point to his ERA not being necessarily league leading. It's like a, you know, 3.3 or 3.4. It's still really good. And I would say, well, he's pitched in front of some really bad defenses. I mean, the Phillies literally in those 3 years had one of the worst defenses of all time.
They've changed it, fortunately. They've kind of put themselves into a position now where they're not that level anymore. But you're right. That's definitely part of it. And that's kind of what makes it even more impressive that he was able to get the results he did
and that park,
with that as a starting point. And the park's been tough for a long time, too.
Yeah. So I think that maybe in this case, Fangraphs WAR does tell the right story. This is one of the best three pitchers in baseball. And he's shown it right now. In that game, there were some hard hit balls that didn't turn out to much. Ketel Marte has been scolding the ball. Scalding. He could be.
He's probably scolding it on the way back to the dugout. But, some version of FU ball. Like, that's a scolding. Yeah,
right. I mean, he hit a 110 mile an hour ground out in that one. He's had. I'm not even looking at numbers. I know he's had at least five or six balls over 105, because he had like three of them in one game. So he is hitting the ball super hard, but that didn't turn out anything. Gabriel Moreno hit a ball 109. That was a line out. Corbin Carroll hit a ball 109, just got a single out of it. So not enough launch angle on those, or just not placed incredibly correctly. They did hit the ball somewhat hard. There's also some sequencing where, like, you know, Christian Walker hits a double in the sixth. Lourdes Gurriel hits a single in the fourth. If you kind of put some of those in the right order, they might have scored some runs. But six was not in the cards for them that night, and Wheeler was dealing.
Yeah, he really was. Now, looking ahead to Game 6, it is the Merrill Kelly-Aaron Nola matchup, again, that comes up for these two teams. We've talked about Kelly a handful of times this season on Rates and Barrels as a guy that's reached a level that I didn't think was possible over the course of this year. A big part of the story for him is a really deep pitch mix. What do you think the keys are going to be for Kelly in terms of getting a certain combination of those things working? Like, which pitches are the most important to him if the Diamondbacks are going to go into Philly and extend this series another game?
I mean, it's actually, to me, not his worst pitches. It's the fastball. It's like, how is he going to use the fastball against them? It's his other pitches that are, you know, his strengths. And his changeup is his best pitch. And in the last game, he threw his changeup more than any other single pitch. You know, can he do that again? Will he surprise them? It's again that sort of advanced scouting strength thing, right? Should he pitch to his strengths and throw a bunch of changeups and be predictable? Or should he throw a bunch more four seamers and sinkers when they're not expecting them? Because they will be hunting those four seamers and two seamers, except their game plan might be, well, let's sit slider because he's not going to give us a lot of four seamers and sinkers, right? And so maybe we can hit that slider, you know, so, you know, the cutter or whatever. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth, but it really matter how he gets strikes, how he uses his fastballs, and how much is he sneaking the fastballs by or using them to surprise attack. It's about the fastballs, because he has really excellent cutter, curve, and change. And he used those really heavily in the last game. And he has to do something different, because like we just showed with the Eovaldi, you kind of come back with something else. And I wonder what that will be for Kelly this year. Maybe this game, maybe it'll be some surprise sinkers.
And then I guess the natural other side of this is Aaron Nola coming off 6 scoreless last time out, 7 Ks, no walks, 3 hits. And it was a gem. And he was able to just hand it over to 3 relievers with a pretty big lead too, because the Phillies started piling on even more after Kelly left that matchup in game 2. What should the Diamondbacks try to do differently? Like, what would your plan of attack be against Nola?
I mean, he's so excellent. I mean, I think the one thing is you got to see what kind of command he has on the curveball that day. Because he does sometimes fall into some fastball curveball patterns where he's like fastball curveball against righties and fastball changeup against lefties. But if he's really placing that curveball, everything is a lot harder. So I tried to spit on the secondaries early and hope that he doesn't have great command of one of them that day.
Are we going to have happy children in the Saras household tonight? Are the Diamondbacks going to find a way to extend it, or is this one ending in 6?
I think this one's ending tonight. Aaron Nola's a big game pitcher. They're, you know, as if that exists, they're at home. The crowd is going to be on their side. The park is on their side in terms of they have the home run hitters. So I'd expect the Phillies to hit more home runs than the Diamondbacks tonight.
Yeah, I think that would be the key. If you can find a way, if you're Arizona, if you can just find a way to launch a few homers early, especially, and kind of take the crowd out of it in the early innings, that goes a long way too, right? The longer this goes, even if Kelly comes up and it's a pitcher's duel through 4 or 5, that crowd's not going to go away. So I think the quicker you can sort of take that element out, the better off you're going to be. That's cliche, but it's generally true. Like, those ruckus crowds they're an extra thing to deal with in October that you don't deal with very often throughout the regular
Walker's
season.
Walker's got to get going. You know, Walker's got to get going. Mm-hmm. If you could do something where, you know, you come out of the first inning and Corbin Carroll and Walker have both gotten hits and you have a run or two, like, that changes everything.
Yeah, just changes the complexion real early out of the gate. I'm with you, though. I do think the Phillies are going to find a way to end this 1-6. Diamondbacks are a nice story. Obviously, anything can happen, but a lot leaning in the favor of the Phillies. I think you push it to 7, though, and things get a little more goofy, right? The disparity in pitching matchup tonight. It's like, if you're the Phillies, you really want to end this right now for every
Who
possible reason.
Game 7 for these teams?
I mean, Fott probably goes again for Arizona, right?
Rookie on the line, game 7. And then it's like the Walker, road. It's the Walker Sanchez. I mean, they haven't even used Walker, but it's Sanchez, yeah, and Holstaff. I mean, it's Holstaff for both.
It's Ranger again. It's the rematch. It's Fott versus Ranger if it goes 7 again. I think they both pitched so well in their game earlier in the series that I sort of just naturally expect the opposite. Either way,
I mean, there was a lot of people arguing that Fott should be left in, and I was like, listen, when we were having this argument about Blake Snell, you know, I get it, you know, Blake Snell, like Cy Young's, and like, as much as I think Brandon Fott's a pretty good pitcher, like, we're really gonna have an argument about taking out a guy who had a 5.7 ERA this year, like he's just like, oh, but today he's amazing. So like, dude, you got to forget that 5.7 ERA. He's just a totally different person today. I was like, no, man, you say thank you so much, man. You gave us 5 2/3. Yes, attaboy, what a great start. And we are taking you out because you are not going to see Kyle Schwarber a third time in this game, dude. I'm sorry.
I had to give him one more batter position. I didn't want him to like go 7 because I didn't think that was a good idea. Because I feel like if you let him go through the whole heart of the order a third time, you're absolutely flirting with it. the reason I wasn't in love with taking Fott out, even though you're going lefty-lefty, it's Sal Frank. Sal Frank's got like 10 big league innings, right?
I know.
Sal Frank against Schwarber to me was like...
And walked Schwarber because he's...
And then you had to use Sal Frank against Turner, and I'm like, what would you rather have done? Just let Fott face Schwarber, and if he walks him, then you go play the matchups you want. And
then you have Fott versus Turner, which is better.
For me, that just comes down to the classic, like, some of the decisions you have to make are actually very hard. As far as which matchups you like, mathematically, they did the right thing. I wanted to do the wrong thing.
Also, because you want Sal Frank against Harper, you know? So it's like, there was two batters there you didn't want Fott against. So that's the real reason you take him out.
I think that was the biggest process. Yeah.
You know,
you get two lefty lefty matchups instead of, you know, going wrong way against Schwarber. Yeah. You're slightly better off. I get why they did it. It's just like, there's some part of me that it's probably having 39 years of old school baseball analysis just like hitting me repeatedly. And I'm like, fine, leave him in for one more. Let's just see what happens. It should be fine. And Schwarber might have hit it.
Should be fine. Schwarber could take you long any moment. Dude.
Well, then he hit one off a lefty. Hit one off of Kyle Nelson later in the series anyway. And it's like, see, these are the guys you're throwing out there. Like, if your lefties aren't like good lefties or great lefties,
that's
are you getting
point.
As much of an advantage as you think?
That's right. That's, I mean, we're talking that's about what I've been wondering. You're not bringing in, you know, vintage Chapman or whatever.
You're not bringing in Jose Alvarado or, you know, yeah, someone exactly. that just throws. Yeah. Gas from the left side. So anyway, it's a debate that will come up again, I'm sure, other times down the road.
It's inevitable. Also the oldest debate. People want to frame it as like this analytics thing, but like it's the oldest debate in the book. I remember one of the first things I remember as a fan was like you took Russ Ortiz out too early. I don't know if you remember this one.
I don't remember that exact instance.
It's 2002. It's Dusty Baker. And the Giants are up 3-1 in the series, and they're up in the game, and Dusty Baker takes Russ Ortiz out and goes to Fernando Rodriguez.
Now you don't remember.
Can't remember the name, but I
you're
just remember.
You're mad about it, though. That's why you're mad about it.
I was mad about it.
If the person you're replacing the starter with is a forgettable reliever,
yes,
that might be an exception to the rule.
That's an easy way to get in trouble. But my point is, this is the oldest argument in baseball. I feel like how many times we argue he took that guy out too early, or he took him out, or he didn't take him out early enough. That's like, you know, that's the ipso facto looking backwards, you know, hindsight is 20/20, the argument of all time in baseball.
Yep. It truly is. And I'm looking forward to the time, probably within the next year, maybe even sooner, where it's going to come up again. And we can rehash it.
Oh, it's coming up in the next 2 days.
Probably in the next 2 days. For sure within the next year. But we are going to go on our way out the door. A few reminders. You can get a subscription to The Athletic. $2 a month gets you in the door at theathletic.com/baseball show. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter/X, you can find Eno at EnoSaris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. Follow Britt as well at Britt_Deroli. That's going to do it for this episode of the 3-0 show. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Tuesday.
We've always got the green light here.
Green light.